Frosty the Coal Man is a jolly, happy soul. Frosty the Coal Man's getting cleaner every day.
Frosty the Coal Man. Music to blow up the climate while the economy melts down. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, your host and janitor for Astonishing Times. In our second half hour...
It's moving much faster than even the scientists expected. The scientists, when you talk to them, are actually frightened. There's an undercurrent of panic in quite a few of the conversations I had, because it's moving faster than their own models predicted. I mean, their models have come under heavy fire from the denialists over the years, but in fact, their models are too conservative, they have come to believe, and that's rather worrisome, because the models were already quite frightening.
Author, historian, and filmmaker Gwyn Dyer gives us a peek at his new project, Extreme Climate Change, Leading to War. Right now, we'll tune in to the saner voices in the god-awful bailout debate for Detroit's big three automakers. You'll get quick service slices of testimony to one of the few congressional committees that really matter. What should an American car industry do? Do we need any more cars at all? After that, in the spirit of the Green Grinch, we'll mix in twisted black Christmas carols and the true facts about coal plant radiation. What? You didn't know coal plants are pumping out bomb-quality radiation every day? Cars, coal, climate, and war. The new Four Horsemen on today's Radio EcoShock show. Ho, ho, ho! What about this government bailout for GM, Ford, and Chrysler? Can these companies change fast enough to meet reality? Let's start out with a quick tour of clips from the testimony to the House about the bailout on December 9th. The Democrat from Massachusetts, Congressman Ed Markey, is the chair of the Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming. I like Markey. He's been battling it out on this pivotal committee through the indifference of the latter Bush days, plotting out a plausible future. The webcast was 2.5 hours long, and we just don't have that kind of time, so I've been quite selective. We'll start out with a couple of opening remarks by Chairman Markey, followed by the committee member from Washington State, Jay Inslee, and then clips of testimony.
A business model premised on bigger cars, wider highways, and more oil is a failed equation. Any recovery of these companies will require more than just fresh cash. It will require a change of culture, a culture that answers challenges with innovation rather than lobbying and litigation, a culture that tries new ideas rather than crushing them. I believe Detroit can be reborn. I have reviewed the pending draft legislation that would make available $15 billion in emergency loans and require the Big Three to withdraw pending lawsuits against the states that support adopting California's greenhouse gas emission standards. I commend that provision and strongly believe that Congress must go one step further and grant the waiver to California, which would allow California, along with 13 other states that want more efficient, less polluting vehicles, to require them.
That was Ed Markey. This is Jay Inslee.
We look at the Renault company that is signing contracts with the Better Place company that is now totally electrifying the transportation fleets of Israel, Australia, Denmark, and now San Francisco. We have to get in this game nationally, or we will be left at the starting post with bridges to nowhere. And so I want to point out that I am hopeful that this Congress will adopt the measures that will assure that the United States gets in this international game at the last possible moment. Let me give you an example why I think it's the last possible moment. We have a company that makes lithium-ion batteries in the Midwest, and right now it's the only potential manufacturer domestically of lithium-ion batteries. They got an offer for about $300 million from China to essentially move their company to China. We are in the cusp of trading addiction to Middle Eastern oil for addiction to Chinese lithium-ion batteries. So we need to make sure that this industry responds to this opportunity by going to the future, not being tied to the past. I've sent a letter November 17th. I'll submit it to letter to Chairman Frank, suggesting six measures: an open fuel standard, investments in alternative fueling infrastructures, energy efficiency requirements, a cash for clunkers program, full funding for plug-in hybrid electric vehicles, and a federal procurement programs. Those measures will assure the United States it doesn't get left at the post in this international competition. Hope we'll get this job done. The future of this industry depends on it.
That was Congressman Jay Inslee from Washington State with his opening remarks to a hearing on energy independence and the implications of the auto bailout. Now we'll go to the first presenter, Joan Claybrook, from the public interest watchdog group Public Citizen, the one founded by Ralph Nader.
I was interested to note that just this week, the General Motors published an ad in Automotive News apologizing to the public for its failure to carry out its obligations, really, to the public for fuel economy and other improvements in their vehicles. One of the most important things is that the auto industry has made promises to have all airbags in all cars by 1975, the president of General Motors, Ed Cole, said, promises to have greater fuel efficiency, all the auto manufacturers said in 2000, by 2005 they'd have a 25% increase. Then they didn't do it. And then they said they were going to have side-head airbags, and then they didn't do it. They did it in some vehicles. Again and again, there have been promises that have not been carried out. Anything that we want these manufacturers to do should be in the law. It has to be in the law, because if it's not done, then organizations like Public Citizen and NRDC and others can sue and force this to happen. And there won't be the delay that there traditionally has been when there have been promises and everyone's relaxed and said, great, they're going to do it, and then they don't do it.
That was Joan Claybrook. Next up is a bit from Ruben Munger, chairman of a startup independent automaker of electric plug-in vehicles called Bright Automotive.
Our flagship product, the first of several from a common platform, is a plug-in hybrid electric vehicle which will go for up to 100 miles per gallon. This is a 5 times improvement over the best-in-class competitor in our class. Bright is on track to be in production at an annual rate of 50,000 vehicles per year by 2012. And to grow from there. As a new startup, Bright will ramp to scale and do it immediately. Our focus is on optimizing platform physics. Beyond just an advanced powertrain, it is a combination of lightweighting, best-in-class aerodynamics, low-rolling resistance tires, sustainable materials, and that advanced electric powertrain that combine to provide truly breakthrough opportunities. This advanced technology vehicle program is currently being...
And I say this, I get tired of people calling it 136, okay? It's what it is. It's the Green Factory, you know, fund, and if people would call it that, then the public would understand what the fight is over.
This loan program is being administered by the Department of Energy. The Green Car Factory Fund is cited in all of the plans of the Detroit 3 as a key component of funding their compliance with new efficiency regulations. Section 136 is a critical component of the transformation of the industry. It has the potential to be the catalyst for achieving positive change. As an example of that, Bright Automotive last week submitted our proposal for a loan under this fund. It is a critical component of the path forward for companies like us, as well as the big three.
We're doing a quick survey of clips about the auto bailout in testimony to a congressional committee. This is Dr. Peter Morrissey, professor of the international business at the University of Maryland. He's less optimistic.
I would say this to you, that right now, as they stand, they are not competitive. They claim they will be in 3 or 4 years. I do not believe that on the basis of what they have shown me. I don't believe that giving them a bailout will make them competitive, no matter how many conditions that we attach. The Congress is very good at writing laws. I don't know that it's very good at the proceedings of a bankruptcy court. And what these industries need to do, these companies need to do, is to go through Chapter 11, or at least have the threat of Chapter 11 with regard to their stakeholders to bring them into line to get the results that they need. They just have too much debt and a labor agreement that doesn't work, and frankly, management that just doesn't see the future clearly enough, although there's considerable variability among the Detroit 3 in that regard. My feeling is if you bail them out, they will politicize the process. They'll find some way around the restrictions on lawsuits and all that. They will find a way to lobby the system. If they don't do it, their union will do it for them. And we will end up, over time, with an industry that is still less cost competitive And when we finally, after hundreds of billions of dollars, decide to cut them loose and go through Chapter 11, it will be a smaller industry than it will be is now, and we will save fewer jobs by reorganizing them. The sooner we give them the cure, the sooner that you know, the more jobs we will save.
Finally, from the design side of the car business, here is Dr. Jeff Wardle, Director of Advanced Mobility Research, Art Center, College of Design in Pasadena, California.
In our written testimony, we make four major recommendations on how to deal with the rescue plan for General Motors, Chrysler, and Ford. But we are here to confirm that the business model of the traditional American automobile industry is broken. The future of personal mobility is no longer just about cars. So insisting that the auto industry develops energy-efficient vehicles is by itself not an adequate prerequisite for financial assistance, in our opinion. I think it's fair to say, though, that the legacy auto industry does an exceptionally good job of designing, developing, and making vehicles that, unfortunately, people no longer really want. Meanwhile, there are startup companies like Tesla, Aptera, Bright Automotive, represented here, and Fisker, that are financially challenged to get products that Americans do need into manufacture and to market. So we would recommend using some of the bailout funds to deploy idle manufacturing capabilities of the legacy companies to enable the startups to get their already developed products to market sooner rather than later and on a meaningful scale. America's current transportation network is based on the Futurama vision that was showcased at the 1939 New York World Fair. We are now well overdue for a brand new Futurama vision, but a vision that does not rely on cheap energy, vast quantities of raw materials, destruction of natural habitats, and disregard for climate change, human safety, and quality of life. So we also recommend that some of the funding should go towards a far-reaching, nationwide, smart, and sustainable network of transportation systems. This will also provide much of the new business for an overhauled and revitalized Detroit, simultaneously providing a guaranteed customer for these new products that they would make.
You have just heard testimony to the U.S. Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming, as webcast from globalwarming.house.gov. I've saved the first hour for you as an MP3 recording at ecoshock.org. Choose transportation from our free audio on demand menu, ecoshock.org. Look in the transportation section. I'm sure there are as many opinions on this Big Three bailout as there are listeners to this show. As an environmentalist, I'm mad as hell at Detroit. They fought off the very demands for fuel efficiency that would have saved themselves and the planet. While I feel for the workers and for the real families there, I saw strikes for more benefits, but no unions protested when GM started building 8-mile-per-gallon Hummers long after the truth about greenhouse gases and depleted oil reserves were well known. Even the last of the Ford family directors objected in a formal statement to the board regarding Ford's dependence on huge gas guzzlers for profits. Groups like Rainforest Action Network and innovators like Amory Lovins tried to work with these companies with no real results. Apparently, the American auto industry was determined to fail, and they've succeeded in doing that. My personal opinion, the bailout is a stall of the inevitable. These companies need to be either disbanded or nationalized. And if nationalized, their first step should be to stop producing cars. North America doesn't need another single oil-powered vehicle. We are already flooded with overcapacity in cars that can't meet the future. Detroit stopped making cars in World War II. They made Jeeps and trucks and airplanes and ship parts and whatever the country needed to survive. Now they need to make train cars, small electric plug-in vehicles, all sorts of personal transport devices, but mostly mass transit, and then more mass transit. Unused capacity could go into making the wind machines and solar furnaces we will need to survive the end of the age of oil, and especially the immediate end of coal. Otherwise, as strange as it may sound in a winter's blast, we'll find an overheated and wrecked world. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. EcoShock.org. Warning, the following sounds may irritate your brain. Do not panic. This is Radio EcoShock.
Frosty the Coal Man is a jolly, happy soul. He's abundant here in America, and he helps our economy roll. Frosty the Coal Man's getting cleaner every day. He's affordable and adorable, and his workers keep their pay. There must have been some magic in clean coal technology, for when they looked for pollutants, there was nearly none to see. Oh, Frosty the Coal Man is a jolly, happy soul. He's abundant here in America, and he helps our economy roll. Thumpity thump thump, thumpity thump thump, look at Frosty go. Thumpity-thump-thumpity-thump towards energy independence we go.
Hey, kids, you remember Frosty the Coal Man, getting greener and greener each day. There must be some miracle, they say. Well, yes, indeed. The coal lobby that puts out these cheery Christmas mockeries needs a very big miracle in their stocking, because there isn't a single clean coal plant in the United States at all. No one captures and stores the deadly carbon dioxide that's wrecking the planet's climate, and as we'll find out today, not the radioactive waste either. They tried building one to get that carbon, but they gave up. And hey, that doesn't stop this front group of the Happy Coal advertisers singing a happy song.
Clean coal is here to stay. Fa la 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 la. Getting cleaner every day. Fa la 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 la.
Did you know the coal industry is producing millions of tons of radioactive materials? Listen up. Our addiction to coal as an energy source has a hidden side effect. Over time, we are creating a huge radioactive burden on the land, sea, and air. Hundreds of thousands of tons of thorium and uranium, including enriched uranium, that could be used by terrorists, all from coal-fired power plants. Planet Earth is a radioactive place. That is why it is still molten hot at the core. Fortunately for life, almost all that dangerous radioactive material was left beneath a protective layer of rock. Humans insist on dragging these poisonous materials to the surface and pouring them out into the air for the insanity of nuclear weapons and reactors. But unseen beneath the surface of our energy economy, coal, too, is adding unbelievable amounts of radioactive waste to your lungs, country, and the global environment. Sometimes one enemy will tell you the real goods about another. The nuclear industry, that glutton demanding more public tax money, is anxious to tell us the real dirt about their competitor, Mr. Coal. Thus, the publicly funded Oak Ridge National Laboratory, infamous for nuclear mismanagement, hosts an article titled Coal Combustion, Nuclear Resource or Danger, written by Alex Gabbard. Gabbard's argument is simple. Coal plants emit more radioactive materials than well-run nuclear plants, he says. Sadly, as industry insider publication like Nucleonics Week report, there are no well-run nuclear plants. They all have breakdowns and some near meltdowns and regular radioactive releases beyond their published specifications. But let's take a closer look at coal with Mr. Gabbard. It takes a huge volume of coal to fuel each and every coal-fired power plant. As you know, entire mountaintops are removed and giant craters are formed just to feed American energy needs. The majority of America's electricity is still generated by coal. Within all that tarry black rock is the usual scattering of radioactive materials common to Earth since the beginning of the planet. But what happens when that radioactivity is concentrated in the coal furnaces? Where does it go? According to Alex Gabbard, back in 1982, the typical coal plant released 12.8 tons of thorium, a radioactive agent known to cause cancer, particularly thyroid cancer. The coal power station also pumped out an astounding 5.2 tons of uranium. Worse, the burning process tends to concentrate the most unstable form of uranium, namely uranium-235, the fuel used for nuclear reactors, and for making atomic bombs. The typical coal plant created 74 pounds of uranium-235. It takes as little as 55 pounds of enriched uranium to make an atomic weapon. We need to know where that potential terrorist gold mine goes. Gabbard's reasonable figures suggest the 174 coal plants in America of 1982 released 801 tons of uranium, including 11,000 pounds of uranium-235. Coal contributed another 1,971 tons of thorium that year alone as well. In 1982, the whole world burned an estimated 2,800 million tons of coal. That adds up to 3,640 tons of uranium, with 51,000 pounds of uranium-235 and 8,900 tons of thorium. In just one year, our coal habit produced more than 10,000 tons of highly radioactive material.
Plenty for years to come.
Coal burning has only increased in China and India since they came online with super-industrialization. Let's assume, by some miracle, the world manages to cut back by the year 2040 to just 2,500 million tons of coal, 10,000 tons less than was burned in 1982. There would still be a horrible radioactive legacy left on Earth. Between the years 1937, when such records began, and 2040, the coal industry would have produced 828,000 tons of uranium, including 5,883 tons of uranium-235, more than 2 million tons of thorium. Using government measurements, Gabbard estimates a release of 477 million millicuries just in the United States by 2040. Globally, almost 3 billion millicuries of radioactivity would be added to the world environment just by coal burning. And that's if we manage to cut back to pre-1982 levels, which certainly isn't happening now. Gabbard couldn't foresee the giant impact of China and India's coal burning, which has already bypassed the United States. China has far fewer scrubbers and other pollution controls. The real figures are much, much worse. How is this possible? Gabbard writes, quote, "During combustion, the volume of coal is reduced by over 85%. It shrinks, which increases the concentration of the metals originally in the coal. Although significant quantities of ash are retained by precipitators, heavy metals such as uranium tend to concentrate on the tiny glass spheres that make up the bulk of fly ash. This uranium is released to the atmosphere with the escaping fly ash at about 1% of the original amount, according to NCRP data. The retained ash is enriched in uranium several times over the original uranium concentration in the coal, because the uranium and thorium content is not decreased as the volume of coal is reduced," end quote. That's because uranium and thorium are not burned. As the coal industry argues, in any particular year, a study of the radioactive emissions from coal plants would show levels lower than the natural background dose of the planet Earth. But, quote, "because the half-lives of radioactive potassium-40, uranium, and thorium are practically infinite in terms of human lifetimes, the accumulation of these species in the biosphere is directly proportional to the length of time that a quantity of coal is burned," end quote. Every year we depend on coal is another year humans add more thousands of tons, more radioactive materials to the so-called background. Lasting hundreds of thousands of years, our radioactive legacy will outlast any human civilization. We will be known as the nuclear dumpers. Gabbard concludes, quote, "although trace quantities of radioactive heavy metals are not nearly as likely to produce adverse health effects as the vast array of chemical byproducts from coal combustion, the accumulated quantities of these isotopes over 150 or 250 years could pose a significant future ecological burden and potentially produce adverse health effects, especially if they are locally accumulated. Because coal is predicted to be the primary energy source for electric power production in the foreseeable future, the potential impact of long-term accumulation of byproducts in the biosphere should be considered," end quote. Let's compare the radioactive burden of nuclear plants or coal plants to alternative energies like solar, wind, geothermal, or tidal power. It's a difference of night and day, a dark and scary night and day. What happens to this bounty of coal-borne radioactivity anyway? The majority of uranium is attracted to the tiny glass particles in coal emissions. About 99% of it is supposed to be trapped by smokestack traps and scrubbers, where they exist, and they don't in China, before they hit the surrounding air. That still means that people living near coal-fired power plants are bombarded with radioactive materials that escape, and not just locals. The uranium glass particles fly up into the upper atmosphere to be transported around the world. People in North America breathe in China's radioactive coal dust, and Europeans breathe in America's pollution. So do Canadians. There's enough particulate matter to form a dirty coal ring around the planet, a kind of radioactive smog laden with tiny heavy metal particles as well. What about the radioactive gunk collected by the scrubbers when they're there? Well, that's another odd angle to this story, hardly discussed outside of military circles. The concentration of uranium-235 in coal ash is strong enough to provide materials for nuclear weapons. Here is Gabbard's diplomatic warning, written back in the 1980s in government talk. Quote, radioactive elements released in coal ash and exhaust produced by coal combustion contain fissionable materials. Such fissionable and fertile materials can be recovered from coal ash using known technologies. These nuclear materials have growing value to private concerns and governments that may want to market them for fueling nuclear power plants. However, they are also available to those interested in accumulating material for nuclear weapons. End quote. And where are we dumping all this radioactive coal ash? Practically everywhere. Some has been shipped overseas. It has been dumped into the oceans. Most of it is piled unattended around our country. The radioactive material will never weaken in terms of human lifetimes. It can hardly be guarded. Yet it is a weakness in terms of national security for every coal-burning country. Gabbard concludes that in 1984, all the American nuclear plants combined consumed about 540 tons of uranium fuel, almost 300 tons less than the 801 tons of uranium produced by the U.S. coal plants that year. So that makes nuclear better in his eyes. He fails to mention there is no known place safe enough to store nuclear waste from reactors, and that all nuclear proliferation, the bombs, to this day have come from reactor byproducts and not from coal ash. At least the nuclear guys give us another reason why coal is not the answer and not even a sustainable energy source for humans, even without the terror of carbon-based climate change.
Technology, technology, you make the coal burn cleanly. Technology, technology, you make the coal burn greenly. America depends on you, just like the past, the future too. Technology, technology, you make the coal burn cleanly.
That's another befouled Christmas classic brought to you by a desperate coal industry. Oh, clean coal technology, if only you existed. Should we dump more and more radioactivity on future generations just to run some inefficient light bulbs? We don't need nuclear power or weapons, and we can't keep burning coal either. We need clean energy sources. Clean energy does exist, the kind we can use for thousands of years, leaving the Earth's surface safe and natural. Let's use that. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Find us at ecoshock.org. One more for the road. Here's another twisted Christmas carol brought to you by americaspower.org. It's like Scrooge humming a little tune about the joys of starving orphans.
Clean, clean coal powers us today. When it comes to energy, there is no better.
Ho, 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 come child, here's a radioactive lump of coal for your stocking. In the second half hour of Radio EcoShock, an exclusive recording of columnist, filmmaker, and war analyst, Gwyn Dyer. Mr. Dyer has discovered a plot among the generals. No matter what George Bush said, the military not only believes in climate disruption, they are planning in detail what they can do when it all hits the fan. Remember, breathe deep and appreciate beauty. Dance if you can. We'll be right back with more Radio EcoShock.
Shock.
There's a better way than barrels of oil. There's a better way than lumps of coal.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock.
After the crop failure, millions moved north over the border.
Gwynne Dyer is a hardened war reporter and author of books on war. Interviews he does with expert generals and top politicians. Building on his material, he continues to research, traveling to key capitals around the world. One bleak and rainy Saturday afternoon in December, Dyer arrived just minutes before his speech in Vancouver's Park Theater. The theater was not just unheated. As frigid air poured down on the audience, Gwynne Dyer stepped up to the single microphone and stood for 2 full hours, explaining nonstop the intertwined currents that are dragging us under as a civilization and perhaps as a species. This war reporter discovered his military men discussing new plans, the tactics of retrenchment under climate disruptions already coming much faster than predicted.
It's moving much faster than even the scientists expected. The scientists, when you talk to them, are actually frightened. There's an undercurrent of panic in quite a few of the conversations I had because it's moving faster than their own models predicted. I mean, their models have come under heavy fire from the denialists over the years, but in fact, their models are too conservative, they have come to believe, and that's rather worrisome because the models were already quite frightening.
In the war games rooms and think tanks, they worried about climate wars, an almost inevitable chain of strife between nations and within nations caused by devastating storms, droughts, and floods, and seaside cities flooding. But the first and foremost, the new wars will come over water as the new climate regime redistributes currents in the atmosphere, those rivers in the sky that carry water to the crops, or not. And the glaciers that keep major rivers flowing to over 1 billion people are melting fast. From Chile to Pakistan, irrigation systems will break down. Cities will run out of water. Food riots and then climate refugees will soon follow, and then war. These are not problems of faraway places. In today's selection from Gwynne Dyer, we'll hear the awful puzzle of the American border with Mexico. Mexico, that country's agricultural lands are already drying out. It is part of the progression of climate change, part of the disease. A wide band of drought and then deserts and dry lands spring up all around the tropics, all around the world, like Australia, like Greece, Italy, and Spain, like the U.S. Southeast and the Southwest, but much worse in Mexico and the rest of Central America. Millions of those hungry people will be forced to move north. Could the American military stop them? How will the 60 or 100 million Mexican-Americans react? What about the many Latins in America's new volunteer army? Dr. Gwynne Dyer has his new book, Climate Wars, inscribed in his brain. He spoke from his book research with references and examples without notes of any kind. Trained as a historian, he became a war journalist and broadcaster, a frequent guest expert in the media. His first television series, the 7-part documentary called War, was aired in 45 countries in the mid-1980s. One episode, The Profession of Arms, was nominated for an Academy Award. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. This speech by Gwynne Dyer is preparation for a new radio series on extreme climate change and war. We'll take a selection and tune in partway.
America is close enough to the equator that, unlike Canada, for example, it does suffer significantly from global warming, and the main impact of global warming in the early stages is on the food supply. It is on the ability to produce food. In the case of the United States, both the Department of Agriculture and the Pentagon, in their sort of off-record calculations, assume that the United States is probably going to lose most agricultural production in the high plains west of the Mississippi within 20 to 30 years. The rain will fail in that area, and at about the same time, they will have pumped that giant aquifer, the Ogallala Aquifer, which they draw most of their irrigation water from, dry. So we're talking about northern Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Colorado, Nebraska, maybe even up to Iowa, places that are now very large producers of food who are mostly or entirely out of food production in 30 years. They also calculate that they will probably lose the Central Valley of California, where they now grow about a third of America's fruit and vegetables. That is essentially a desert, which is irrigated by water from principally the Colorado River. Southern California is a Mediterranean climate. It doesn't rain there in the summertime. There is only water in the Colorado River in the summertime because the snow falls in the Sierra Nevada in the winter, builds up the snowpack, and it is that snowpack melting in the summer that keeps the river full in the summer. At 2 degrees hotter, that precipitation falls as rain, not snow, most of it, in the wintertime, and runs straight off into the river, and so you have flooding all winter, no snowpack, and no water in the river in the summer when you want it. Bye-bye, Central Valley. So the United States takes big hits, but it's a large, agriculturally rich country. They'll always be able to feed themselves in, you know, in the lower range of temperature rise, 1 or 2 degrees. It will always be raining in the lands nearer the coast, and there's enough good agricultural land near the coast, particularly in the eastern half of the country, to feed even the 400 million Americans we may expect in 30 or 40 years. But Mexico and Central America are a very different story. Every climate scenario I have seen predicts that they dry out almost entirely. They're already a relatively dry area. They're the subtropics, and the rainfall there simply fails, and the farms dry up and blow away. So that instead of the current migration northwards of economic immigrants, migrants who some very few legally and most illegally cross the border into the United States, in numbers that the United States basically is willing to tolerate, not in a wink, we pretend to try to keep the border closed, but go 10 kilometers out of any city along the border in either direction and you'll see only three strands of wire and nobody watching them as the border. It's a sort of deliberately porous border that allows enough Mexican migrants in to provide cheap stoop labor on American farms, and it provides a safety valve for Mexico and keeps that country stable. Remittances go back, people go on eating. That's the situation now. But once drying hits in a big way and the farms begin to fail, there are 200 million people in Mexico and Central America, and they will find it very difficult to feed themselves. And so that flow northwards may be expected to multiply many times, sufficiently so that the demand in the United States to close that border really will become irresistible. The Pentagon looks at this prospect, understands that it is going to be told sometime in the next 10 years, probably, or no more than 15 years, to really shut that border down, and considers its options, and it doesn't like what it sees. They're quite sophisticated in the Pentagon in many ways. Closing the border is no problem. We can close borders very easily in the sense that the drill is perfectly straightforward. Two words, iron curtain. We know how to close borders. In the case of Mexico, what you would do is you would build a 3-meter-high razor wire fence and run a high-voltage current through it. And then behind that, you build a ditch, a dry moat about 3 meters deep, 10 meters wide. You put your motion detectors down there. And at the other lip of the ditch, you put up another 3 meter high fence, and on that one, you put your video cameras, your searchlights, and your remote control machine guns. And you can also put landmines down in the ditch. And you have closed the border. I'm not inventing these specs. Those are the actual specs for the border that the Saudi Arabians are building along their frontier, 900 kilometers of it, with Iraq right now. I've seen the contract. And it doesn't cost that much. 3,000 kilometers of border between the U.S. and Mexico, putting a defense like that right along, it would cost about 2 months' worth of the Iraq war. But it will only work if you're willing to kill people. Even such a fence will not keep people out unless there are the landmines and the machine guns. You've got to be willing to kill people. Now, in principle, I don't think the U.S. Army has a huge problem with killing people. But they look at this problem and they don't like what they see, because already 1/6 of the American population is of Mexican and Central American descent. It will almost certainly be a quarter by the time that border gets fortified. And the question they ask themselves is, how are Americans of Mexican and Central American descent going to view the sight of relatives being machine gunned at the border? And the answer is almost certainly not in a very positive light. So what they anticipate is that if they're ordered to close the border and do it in the way that they know how to do, they may be sowing the seeds for the gravest division in the American population since the American Civil War. That's the kind of thinking that is going on in the Pentagon about domestic issues right now. They're not too keen on that prospect.
If America avoids a civil war due to climate refugees, says Gwynne Dyer, other countries may wind up using nuclear weapons under the stress.
Let's move to the other end of the spectrum. How would you get, let's say, a nuclear war out of climate change? Just a local nuclear war, you understand. A few hundred warheads, a few hundred million dead. But a nuclear war. Well, all of the major rivers of Asia, or at least of South and Southeast Asia, rise in the Himalayan mountains or the Tibetan high plateau behind. And they're all fed by glaciers. The Indus River in Pakistan, the Ganges in India, the Brahmaputra, which crosses India and then goes to the sea through Bangladesh, the Salween in Burma, the Mekong between Cambodia and Laos and Vietnam, and the Huang He, the great river of southern China, all arise in glaciers in the high Himalayas or the high Tibetan plateau, which perform essentially the same function as the snowpack on the Sierra Nevada. Those glaciers build up their mass in the wintertime with snow, and then they melt at the front during the summer, and they keep those rivers full during the summer. But they're melting. Chinese Academy of Science, and it's in China that most of the glaciers are located, has assessed that they are losing mass at 7% a year. 7% a year means that they're half gone in 10 years. They're almost entirely gone in 20. So for the next 10 or 15 years, you can expect massive floods as the glaciers melt and overfill the rivers, and then rivers that are half empty or worse during the summer when they are required to irrigate the crops. For some countries, this will be a large nuisance or a grave burden, but there's one country for which it is a national disaster, and that's Pakistan. Pakistan is essentially a river running through a desert. 6 tributaries joining together to form the Indus River and going to the sea. Well, it doesn't actually reach the sea anymore. They've taken all the water out by then. But the Indus River is Pakistan. It supplies the largest single irrigated area on the planet. And about 90% of Pakistan's food is grown on the Indus or on its tributaries or just off of them with irrigation. The whole country could feed about 10 million people off agricultural land that does not depend on the Indus, and there's 175 million Pakistanis. Now, that river, like the other rivers coming off the glaciers on the Tibetan Plateau, all six of those tributaries have a glacier at their head, is going to be a lot emptier in the summer when the glaciers are gone. This would be a very serious problem, but not a cause of war, if those rivers flowed directly into Pakistan, but they don't. Five of the six tributaries flow through India on the way to Pakistan, through Kashmir or the northern Punjab. Now, there is a deal. There's a treaty. It dates back to 1960 on the division of the water. And India, by that treaty, is allowed to take a certain volume, a fixed volume of water, out of those tributaries and then allow the rest to flow through to Pakistan. And in fact, Pakistan gets most of it. It was and is far more dependent on the irrigation from the Indus than India is. So India has an allotted proportion. It's not measured as a percentage of flow. It's a given volume of water, you know, 8 cubic kilometers. They probably measured in acre feet back in the 60s, but that amount of water is what India can take out and the rest flows through to Pakistan, which works fine when the river's full. It works less well when the river's half full. And Pakistan still takes its allotted volume out. India still takes its allotted volume out. Would the Indians in those circumstances be saintly enough to say, well, I know the contract says we, the treaty says we can take this much out, but we'll only take our fair share? I'd like to think so, but I think Gandhi died some time ago. And India will not be comfortable in its food supply either. It's a much bigger country than Pakistan. It has other sources of water than just rivers coming off the Himalayas. The monsoon comes in from the southwest and the other one comes in from the northeast. And a good deal of India is not in that zone that depends on rivers from the high Himalayas and the Tibetan Plateau at all. Nevertheless, I was in New Delhi about a year ago and interviewing the head of a think tank in New Delhi called IRADE, the Institute for Research and Development. And the head of the IRADE told me that she had just finished doing a contract for the World Bank on what 2 degrees hotter average global temperature would do to the Indian food supply. So she put her people on it, and they divided India up into 180-some grid squares, and they did an analysis for each of those squares about 100 kilometers on a side. Does the monsoon still get here? Does it get here on time? Can we still double crop this land? Are we down to one crop a year now? Do we even have to change to a less thirsty crop at 2 degrees hotter? Aggregated all the numbers and went back to the World Bank and said, at 2 degrees hotter, India loses 25% of its food production. There are 1.1 billion Indians at the moment, so we're talking about 275 million people without food, and there'll be a good deal more Indians by the time this happens. So the likelihood of India being remarkably generous is pretty small. But if India takes its allotted share out of the Indus tributaries, the five that flow across the Punjab and Kashmir, takes that volume, and it's there in black and white in the treaty, there ain't much left for Pakistan. And I am assuming here, as all the scenarios do assume, that by 20 years from now, there's not going to be an international grain market anymore, that enough countries will have taken serious hits, that almost nobody's exporting grain. Some have enough, some don't, but nobody's exporting much. So you can't buy your way out of trouble, even if you've got the money. What do the Pakistanis do if the Indians stand on the legality here? They're about to starve. And there is a saying among anthropologists, people always raid the neighbors before they starve. Now, they're talking about the little societies anthropologists deal with, but I can think of no good reason why big societies don't behave the same way. We haven't been in this situation for a very long time, but I am not confident that we will behave differently than our ancestors if we find ourselves in it again. And both of these countries have nuclear weapons. I was talking to one Indian diplomat who had been at the negotiation. We had this crisis between Pakistan and India in 2002 up in Kargil in Kashmir, and they came quite close. They mobilized on the border, and there was talk about nuclear weapons coming out. So there were talks about calming this down, and a delegation of Indians actually went to Karachi and talked to their opposite numbers, civilians. And this fellow said to me, you know, at one point, somebody in our delegation said, you do understand we control the water, as a threat. And immediately one of his Pakistani opposite numbers said, you do understand we have nuclear weapons. So, floods of refugees, possible regional wars, especially where there are countries upstream and downstream in the same river. Turkey's upstream of Iraq. Ethiopia and Sudan are upstream of Egypt. These are the areas where you could get very ugly things happening, at least regionally.
We're listening to Gwynne Dyer in her new speech given in Vancouver, December 6, 2008. And all of this problems that he's outlining comes from climate disruption as the atmospheric wind and weather patterns change due to heating. Dyer explains this future very well.
And the biggest of the three factors is a phenomenon called the Hadley cells. The Hadley cells are an atmospheric circulation, the biggest atmospheric circulation, responsible, among other things, for the trade winds. And indeed, the guy who named them, an Irish scientist called Hadley, about 200 years ago, was in fact trying to explain where the trade winds come from. And he deduced that there was, and indeed it's subsequently been experimentally proved, is a very large atmospheric circulation which begins at and near the equator, say 1,000 kilometers either side of the equator, of course very hot, of course very high evaporation from the sea and even from the land, so that at the surface and near the equator there is always moist, hot air. And because it's hot, it rises. And as it rises, it cools. I mean, you lose 3 degrees of temperature Celsius for every 1,000 meters of altitude you go up. Walk up any mountain, and you'll feel that on your skin. As the hot, moist air rises, it cools, and therefore begins to lose its moisture, because cold air can contain less moisture than hot air. So, hence the torrential tropical downpours, is that moist, hot air goes up, it loses its moisture, you have the downpours, and high above the equator, 6,000 or 7,000 meters up near the top of the troposphere, you've got cold, dry air all the time. And that cold, dry air, I'm going to flip this invisible diagram here, so that's the equator, here we are high above it, that cold, dry air is then pushed away from the equator, north and south, by more warm, moist air coming, hot, moist air coming up from below. It's a continuous cycle. The cold, dry air travels north or south, 3,000 kilometers or so, and then it comes back down to the surface, and as it comes down in altitude, the pressure goes up and it warms. Gases heat up under pressure. It hits the ground as hot, dry air, and that is what causes the world's deserts. And then it goes back to the equator on the surface, picking up moisture as it goes, and that's the trade winds. But it's the deserts that concern us here. That hot, dry air descending to the surface creates a belt of deserts around the planet at around 3,000 kilometers from the equator. And that is how the deserts are arranged. They're not scattered randomly around the place. They're in two belts. In the northern hemisphere, you take the great southwestern desert of the United States and of northern Mexico, and you go straight east across the Atlantic on the same line of latitude, and you are in the Sahara Desert of northern Africa. Keep going east, and you are in the Arabian Desert, east across the Indian Ocean, and you are in the deserts of Pakistan and northwestern India. A belt all the way around the planet. Same in the southern hemisphere, Atacama Desert of Peru and northern Chile. Straight east across the South Atlantic, and you're in the Kalahari Desert of Namibia, Botswana. and keep going east, and you are in the great central Australian desert, the Dead Heart, all along the same line of latitude in the southern hemisphere. So these two belts of desert created by the Hadley cells are a permanent phenomenon on the planet, but when you put more heat into the system, more energy, the Hadley cells expand. And that hot, dry air comes down further away from the equator on top of where we now grow most of the world's food, the so-called breadbaskets of the planet, the American Midwest, the Mediterranean Basin, the North Indian Plain, the Australian wheat fields, the corn-growing, maize-growing area of southern South Africa and Zimbabwe, the similar area in northern Argentina and southern Brazil. The breadbaskets, where we raise probably about half of the world's grain, get hit by that hot, dry air, and productivity begins to fall. They don't all turn into open desert by any means, but they do lose the critical rainfall that makes them so fertile. This process is now almost certainly underway in Australia, which is the driest continent. It's where you'd expect it to happen first. I was in Australia in September, and basically the Australians have come to the conclusion that they're going out of the wheat exporting business. They have been for 7 years in the worst drought since European settlement in the late 1700s, so bad that they banned irrigation throughout that vast inland area where they grow their wheat, western New South Wales, northern Victoria, and the similar area in western Australia. These areas are, of course, just below the desert, just below the Great Central Desert in latitude, the Great Central Desert of Australia. And now farm families there are going broke at the rate of 10,000 or 15,000 a month, and they're growing virtually no wheat because it hasn't rained for 7 years. And they're beginning to suspect that this is not really a drought, because droughts, after all, end. That's one of their characteristics, and the rainfall comes back, normal service is resumed. But this may not be a drought. This may be climate change, in which case this is the new normal. Now, if that repeats, and there is absolutely no reason to think it won't, in other big breadbasket areas, we are heading for a global shortage of food. And it is beginning to repeat in the sense that, for example, you're having these catastrophic forest fires in southern Europe. The Greeks lost half of all the forest in their country in a series of desperate forest fires the summer before last. Hot and dry, so hot and dry, there was nothing you could do about it. Spain, Italy are drying out. Spain is half desert already, but the other half is going fast. They're importing a full tanker load of water to Barcelona every day from southern France, because they simply don't have water to keep the people going. One reason why the European Union may eventually break up, by the way, if the southern members are so desperate that they really can't get by where they're living anymore, how do the northern Europeans, who are relatively okay because it's still raining up there, how are they going to feel about free movement through the European Union? I mean, I'm sure that the Swedes like the Italians, but do they really want to welcome 60 million of them?
Food shortages, definitely a topic for an upcoming Radio EcoShock show. Should you be stocking up, if you can? Find more at our Radio EcoShock website, ecoshock.org. Another source along the same lines as Gwyn Dyer is the 2004 book, The Next World War, Tribes, Cities, Nations, and Ecological Decline, by Roy Woodbridge from the University of Toronto Press. In his December 6th speech, Dr. Dyer came up with a surprising conclusion, the desperate hope of geoengineering. That's all in his new book, Climate Wars, described as a terrifying glimpse of the none-too-distant future by one of the world's great geopolitical analysts. We've been privileged to have him on our show today. His website is www.gwynndyer.com. The spelling of his first name, G-W-Y-N-N-E, and his last, D-Y-E-R, is odd for most of us. Just Google D-Y-E-R and climate wars. We are totally out of time. I'm Alex. Visit ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening. Next week, muchachos.